Hi everyone, I'm Kyle Boucher, and this is the AAF Exchange, a podcast from the American Action Forum, where experts provide clear, data-driven insights into today's economic and domestic policy issues. Welcome, and thank you for tuning in. On this episode of the AAF Exchange, should Congress extend the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the Child Tax Credit? Joining us is AAF Vice President for Economic Policy, Gordon Gray, and special guest, Michaela Carr. Michaela is an outside AAF fiscal policy expert. She joins us after a career on the Hill that includes senior roles on the Ways and Means Committee and the Speaker's Office. Gordon, it's good to see you again. It's been a little while since we've had a good chat about fiscal policy or economics.
Several minutes.
I think the last time was, you know, the CR fight, which is always fun to talk about. And Michaela, thanks for joining us. It's also good to meet you, internet-wise, at least.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
But I think this conversation is, you know, a very important one. You know, 2025 is when all this expires. So the next Congress and the next president will have to deal with this. It's a good conversation that we should be having and need to be having throughout this election cycle. But let's start by looking at the bipartisan agreement that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee did to extend the provisions, some of the provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and expand the child tax credit. So, you know, could you, both of you, Michaela, start with you, or just walk us through the details of what this agreement is.
Absolutely, Kyle. And I'll admit some of my own bias here. I was at Ways and Means when then Chairman Brady did Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So I do have an acknowledgement of my own bias of that piece of legislation. But what the tax extenders package that passed at the end of January did was it really extended a lot of the really key provisions that were in TCJA that were ready to expire in 25. It locked in some pro-growth policies, including research and development expensing, so that businesses of all size can immediately deduct the cost of their U.S. R&D. It extended interest deductibility. That really helps small and medium-sized businesses meet payroll, allows for 100% expensing, which is something we didn't have in TCJA. And one of my personal favorite provisions here is it ends the double taxation on businesses and workers operating in both U.S. and Taiwan, which in my view, really strengthens America's competitive position versus China. Obviously, we're not in a position right now to enter into treaty agreements with Taiwan. And so what this really does is gives benefits to companies operating in both places without having to go through the long and kind of messy treaty process. It also does some increases for small business expensing. It cuts off the really wasteful COVID-era spending program that was the employee retention credit that was passed on a bipartisan basis to help America get through COVID. What it ended up doing was being really overrun with rampant fraud. And so this provision stops that in its tracks. And according to independent analysis, we'll save more, that provision alone could save more than $70 billion. And then also maintains the child tax credit structure. We'll talk about this in a little bit more detail, but this was ended up being kind of one of the more controversial portions of this extension package. What it really does is supports middle-class families struggling with high prices by adding an inflation adjustment to the $2,000 child tax credit top line starting in 2024. So those are some of the provisions that are in the extender package. Again, this passed the House January 31st by a resounding 357-70. So from my perspective, good compromise, good legislation. You know, we have a bipartisan split government at this point. And this is pretty much, I think, the most you could hope for good tax policy and a real bipartisan win.
Yeah, I think what, you know, Michaela characterized the legislation, and I also think characterized sort of the potential for sort of what the realm of the reasonable could have been around legislating on this. And I think she characterized it aptly, and also shined a bit of a light on a key element of this, which is the Taiwan related provisions that tend to get a little, you know, forgotten in the commentary on the pure tax TCJA changes. And I think particularly in the current environment where, you know, I look around the world and I see nothing but growing threats. I think leveraging all elements of U.S. diplomatic, military, and economic power is essential and critical. And I'm delighted to see that they were able to move this. So I think that's an important element. And then another element that we touched on a little bit is just looking forward to 2025. And some of this tax legislating is in some ways just kind of housekeeping, is because of the way, and, you know, Michaela had a front row seat to this Ways and Means, because of the way that they had to enact the TCJA through the reconciliation process that has particular rules that really influenced the construction of the legislation and required sunsetting some elements of that. And those elements are the ones that are in this bill. And some of this is just housekeeping, just to get us to essentially TCJA as it was originally enacted, just to sort of set the table for the big tax debate that we all know is coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, with a divided Congress, it seems like that is pretty much what was on the table, those housekeeping items. I know you guys have talked about that. But, you know, a lot of the debate over this bill has revolved around the child tax credit elements on there. And, Kayla, you started mentioning this a little bit. What are the key arguments at issue with that?
So this is such an interesting conversation in my mind to be had, and it really kind of takes us back to first principles. What is the purpose of the tax code? What is the purpose of tax credits? Why is it that the, you know, big G government writ large tries to incentivize behavior through the tax code? And the child tax credit is such an interesting portion of that, because it really kind of boils down to the fundamental question is, what is the purpose of a tax credit? So for someone who is fiscally conservative, small g government, small c, conservative fiscal policy, I think, look, tax credits should exist to make the tax code more fair. That is different than tax credits being used in place of safety net programs. Safety net programs exist to help poor families out of poverty. That is the purpose and use of a safety net program. Both things have a place, but one should not be confused with the other. And so a lot of the conversation around the change to the child tax credit was a sometimes less nuanced conversation of what is this change doing to the purpose of the underlying child tax credit? So the child tax credit's in place to say there are additional costs in this society with raising children. If you are a working family, a working parent, we're going to give you some of that income back in the form of a credit when you have spent these additional costs raising a child. Because it's a tax credit, we say, well, you have to earn income, you have to earn money in order to be eligible for that credit. And we were able to strengthen, Congress strengthened the child tax credit in Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017 by requiring there to be a Social Security number attached to it, by requiring there to be kind of real strict ability to get into the system on this. So those restrictions were maintained, but it expanded the availability of the child tax credit so that you could look at prior years and say, hey, in prior years, did you earn enough? And we're gonna count some of that, which changes the work requirement a little bit. Doesn't eliminate the work requirement, but allows you to look back, which kind of turns the work requirement into an almost every other year. And it allows you to phase in faster with more kids, and allows for, as I mentioned, an increase in total amount because of, you know, the cost of inflation. But to hear the arguments being talked about around the passage of this bill, it was, oh, we've totally lost all sense on what is the purpose of the child tax credit or tax credits generally, or this is a welfare program now. And I think, you know, my takeaway from this is we are once again in divided government. When you, Kyle and Gordon, were talking about, you know, the reconciliation process and what we had to do to pass the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, here we have, I think it was 357 members of Congress voted for these extenders. A lot of those were Democrats who voted against the original Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and here they are voting to prolong, voting to kind of make permanent or to keep the really good pro-business, pro-growth, pro-America portions of this tax bill, with the exchange being we have a slightly softened child tax credit, but we still weren't eliminating the work requirement. So I think it was a really, really interesting conversation about kind of what is fundamentally the purpose of tax credits, why do we have them at all, and how does that interplay with the purpose of a safety net and taking care of the most vulnerable in our society in a fiscally responsible way.
Just going to add that I think Michaela characterized so the rationale for the child tax credit perfectly. And I think that's a valuable insight because of the debate around expansion of the child tax credit and some of the other changes, because you kind of have to think about, you know, what is the underlying rationale? What principle is at work here? And one of the issues of the child tax credit, it has evolved in a bipartisan fashion, but has been sort of variously championed by sort of different poles of our political system at different times, and that can at times give it something of a sense of being a partisan issue, where it's almost been a hot potato that sort of different poles have passed to each other. When underlying this is a sort of bipartisan consensus. From a sort of pure tax policy standpoint, I think the way Michaela characterized the child tax credit as basically offsetting additional costs from having kids is consistent with the view that the tax code should in fact, particularly in the individual tax code, which for a lot of people is essentially supposed to tax your net income from labor. And there's a lot of costs associated with having kids conceptually should be expensable, but they're not under the individual tax code. And this is something of or works like being neutral to the decision to have a child. There's a number of other elements that have been layered on top and mixed up in the child tax credit, along with every other element of the U.S. tax code. So U.S. tax policy will never look like a textbook example. And people disappointed by that and have their votes and views animated by that ideal, I think will always be disappointed. And so I think we need to just look at what is the realm of the achievable, what is the function of the child tax credit, and how does it otherwise incentivize people to work and make other decisions? And I think that a lot of the debate has gotten a bit overblown, and I think we've got an independent analysis on what the economic and labor effects of this particular expansion will be, and they're necessarily modest because the policy change at issue here is relatively modest. I think we need to, as ever, particularly when it comes to tax policy, have a little bit of perspective, particularly in light of some of the invective, I think, that's been invoked in this debate.
That's a really good point, Gordon. And, you know, when we kind of layer on top, the realm of the achievable is so important. And as someone who remembers, you know, going through the passage of TCJA, which was, of course, the most comprehensive tax reform that this country had undertaken in 30 years. And to now turn around and have a 357 vote to extend some of those best provisions, you know, I think that's a win for the country. I think that's a win for fiscal policy. I think that's a win for thoughtful tax policy, substantive tax policy that encourages and allows businesses to thrive in this country. And I think we should be celebrating that as a win while understanding, there might be provisions that to your phrase, well, that's not a textbook example. Well, that's not how a credit should be used. That's not pure. That's not a pure credit because you're allowing lookbacks into prior years or look ahead into future years. Well, yeah, but legislation that can pass the House with 357 votes isn't going to be pure, but it might still be good for the country and good for the economic stability and pro-growth policies in America.
Yeah, I mean, beyond the child tax credit, the bill includes some tax changes to the business tax side of things. You know, I thought the TCJA made some of those tax business changes. What is that about?
Certainly, Michaela understands all these, having helped write them into law. But just to start, is the majority of the business tax reform that the TCJA enacted was permanent. However, again, because of the need to restrain some of the long-term revenue implications, just to make sure that the TCJA complied with parliamentary requirements, did require some changes to the business title in the out years. And there are three big ones. And substantially, the first one was essentially when TCJA was first enacted, businesses were allowed to expense 100% of their investment in business fixed investment, basically everything but buildings. This is a very powerful economic policy. There's a significant literature on why this is not only sort of the correct treatment of investment, but also substantially pro-growth. One of the problems with how the TCJA had to get over the finish line in the Senate was, as I said before, the reconciliation process, they kind of had to loosen this provision up a little bit. Over time, the amount that businesses can expense declines. So it goes from 100% and declines thereafter. And one of the key provisions in the tax bill that we're talking about today and that Congress is considering is bumping that back up to 100% until 2025. Some other provisions are the amortization of R&D expense. So not unlike the treatment of investment under the TCJA when first enacted. Historically, businesses had been able to write off investment in research and experimentation. Again, because of the parliamentary considerations of TCJA, they had to loosen this one up too. And so businesses now have to amortize those expenses. Again, this is a departure from what I think a lot of us would view as the right and proper treatment of business expenses, and also moves away from a pro-growth tax code. And the last element is same thing sort of at play. When they enacted TCJA, they had to give up some policies to fit with the budgetary requirements. And this also attends to a provision in TCJA that restricted the abilities of companies to write off the interest on their loans. So this is net interest expense. Under this provision, the definition of interest tightens up a little bit. So businesses unable to write off as much interest as they otherwise would. And the provision in the tax bill that Congress is considering now would essentially restore the TCJA treatment of interest. So that element is also a bit of a revenue loss there. And again, this is all setting the table to essentially get the TCJA business provisions and substantially teed up for the 2025 sort of reassessment of the TCJA writ large.
And, you know, those three points that you're, those three elements that you're talking about, it's so interesting because there was so much, you know, 5 years ago, so much resistance, I think, from a portion, from a political perspective, to putting these in TCJA. And I think that when you look at the last 5 years, they've been proven to be helpful. Economic benefits of 100% expensing have been proven. U.S. investment grew 20% after tax reform passed, with 100% expensing being a notable crucial factor in that turnaround. Same with proven economic benefits of interest deductibility. U.S. business debt levels fell by 35% after GOP tax reform or the TCJA tax reform was passed, allowing companies to lower their expenses, allowing them to raise wages and create more financial security. And the same can be said for the economic benefits of research and development expensing. Research R&D expensing exploded, R&D investment exploded after TCJA was passed. It created new job opportunities for an innovation in America. More than $2 trillion was invested in new facilities in research and development in the 2 years after tax reform was passed. And so when you look at these three elements, all of which, you know, Gordon walked through why we had to have it the way that we did when tax reform was initially passed, but then in the years since, the actual economic benefit of these provisions has been proven. And it's really, again, you know, it's heartening to see such robust support for these provisions being made permanent for these provisions. It's almost like this is the new status quo. We know this works. We know these are pro-growth policies. And to have a huge vote out of the House, you know, let's really hope that we can continue that kind of bipartisan support for these really pro-growth, pro-business, pro-small business provisions that really encourage growth in America and economy.
So, I mean, both of you are veterans of Congress. Michaela, more recently on the House side. Gordon, you have experience working in some Senate offices back a couple years ago. And, you know, but
more than a couple, I'm afraid.
Yeah. I wasn't going to try and age you there, Gordon, but I, you know.
The camera does that all on it, though.
Yeah. So, but anyways, given the current state of Congress, I think it's a huge accomplishment that they even got it over a first hurdle, that they got, you know, they got a bipartisan agreement, they got a vote towards this, but, you know, the Senate still has to do work, and they have to come make sure if there's any changes, obviously conference, and feel like I'm doing the Schoolhouse of Rock video and we should just cue the music. But what's the outlook for the passage of this bill?
Well, yeah. So you mentioned that Gordon left the Hill before I did. My departure from the Hill is a good reminder why I should not be a political prognosticator. But I do think that I'm eternally optimistic, mostly because of the litany that I just ran through on how good these policies are for American economy, for American businesses, for pro-growth. Also, really nice to have a little bit of a dig to China with the Taiwan provision. That took a long time and a lot of work, a lot of different committees involved. And Wyden's name's on this bill. So it was the Wyden-Smith, in the House version, it was the Wyden-Smith bill, which just gives me a little extra optimism that we'll be able to get this through the Senate. And I think it's important to do so because showing that this can be signed into law by the president will be a really good table setter for 25, because not only are the provisions that we've all talked about here on the chopping block because of expiration dates, but it's also like a really good time to look at all of TCJ, every provision in there that is potentially expiring in 25, and have some robust support for continuing to allow pro-growth policies. After the COVID pandemic and the lockdowns and everything that happened, we need every single leg up that we can to help our economy continue to grow and to help be competitive on the international stage. These policies do that. And so I'm gonna remain optimistic for the next 10 months and see if we can't get Schumer to move this through the Senate as well.
You know, I think Michaela characterized the significance of these tax policies, and I think may need a little optimism in this instance. And part of that is it's difficult to characterize in some ways on the Senate side, not because of, there have been a couple specific objections made, but that's less of the, that characterizes the reception that this got less than just something of a lack of enthusiasm, particularly from the ranking member's side. I think there's a view that the House had a markup, and I know some members of the Senate Finance Committee feel they should have a similar process in the Senate. There's some back and forth between the House and Senate on what the relative sort of buy-in into the process was. It conspicuously absent from sort of signing off on this deal was the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee. There has not been by any stretch, a firm rejection of this. But it, for now, there does not seem to be a tremendous amount of enthusiasm this doesn't seem to be a tremendous priority at the moment. That doesn't suggest that it won't become one later, and for a lot of the reasons that, you know, Michaela articulated. So one of the key elements of this provision is that it's paid for, and as Michaela talked about, by repealing the employee retention tax credit, which was a COVID-era policy, one of the number of policies that the U.S. government deployed at a time of tremendous uncertainty. You know, it was just a very different time, and we did not know entirely what we were confronting. And it was a well-intentioned policy that was essentially designed to keep people at their jobs while we sort of figure out the pandemic. And it has since exploded in cost, and particularly as we've come out of the recovery, and it has long passed its time. And simply eliminating it in and of itself would be good policy. It is rolled into this piece of tax legislation and has the benefit of offsetting it. A lot of us think that's a good thing. If you're a tax writer that may, or a tax member of a tax committee that is in the business of having to extend tax policies regularly, you don't want the obligation to pay for things going forward. You know, as we've recently seen, our the U.S. Fiscal house is in substantial disorder. And maybe maybe getting in the habit of paying for things wouldn't be the worst thing.
All right, I have a couple of questions left. I don't want to keep either of you too much longer, but I do want to talk about the larger debate. So how does this conversation shape the larger debate about the entire Tax Cuts and Jobs Act? We've already said that in 2025, most of this is going to expire. So the next Congress is going to have to deal with it. This election will hopefully be a discussion about that. So how should policymakers be thinking about the looming expiration of these various provisions?
So, you know, I would like to use this as a bellwether. I would like to say this bill has wide bipartisan support. I think Gordon's analysis of what's going to happen in the Senate is accurate. I'm still going to be optimistic. There's a lot that needs to be done for this to get through the Senate and signed by the president. But sometimes that end of year panic sets in, and that can be the driving feature. And if I'm right about that, and this is a bipartisan win, even on this relatively modest package, I think it serves as a really good bellwether to say, look, there's widespread support for the pro-growth policies that are in this bill. Let's take that momentum into 2025 and look at tax policy, not through R's versus D's, not through the lens of politics, but through the lens of what's the right pro-growth policy for America, especially with the looming kind of pandemic lockdowns in the back of our minds. What can we learn from that? And so I think it's a really good opportunity to say we have now gained really significant bipartisan support for a lot of provisions that were considered pretty controversial and are now being embraced. And so I would like to say that bodes well for the future and bodes well for tax policy and actually having really good, thoughtful pro-growth tax policy moving forward. And I think, you know, Gordon mentioned our fiscal house. We have a lot that we're going to have to deal with. Not only do we have, a looming lack of government funding coming early next month, then we're going to have a debt limit situation coming in January. And that's going to be really the kickoff conversation to what the tax code should be generally. And so all in 25, you know, there's a lot that we're going to need to unpack, and that regardless of kind of what the election shakeout is of the makeup of the White House, the House, and the Senate, this is a really interesting time to say, you know, what will be the economic outlook of America with a rising China, with, you know, significant conflicts around the world. So I'm optimistic that TCJA will kind of serve as almost laying the framework and saying, look, some of these things work, let's keep those. Let's use the bipartisan support from early 2024 to say, we have support for this, let's run forward. But there's a lot of really important stuff coming up. And so we need to be thinking about that now and not waiting until middle of 2025 when we feel that there's a real crunch.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, there's a lot to go, and I had totally forgotten about the debt limit is coming back. Like, I keep putting that out of my head, and it's like, that's coming back again. So here we
go.
Right
around the corner.
Yep. So, I mean, what happens if Congress fails to extend these provisions, though?
So I think we'll see a real constriction. I think we'll see, you know, after, when you take kind of past this prologue, right, you take what we saw happen after the passage of TCJA, you saw significant support for some of these policies, and you saw companies take advantage of these policies. You saw companies giving bonuses and credits. You saw them increasing in hiring. You saw them increasing in investment for research and development. You saw an increase in investment for building facilities. You saw an increase in kind of activity. And if the provisions are taken away, I think you can continue to want to know that companies are going to want to grow, but if they're not going to have a friendly and hospitable soil here in the U.S., they'll find somewhere else, which is some of the what we were trying to counter during TCJA. You know, their private companies have an opportunity to build their company and grow their company anywhere. Countries like Ireland are really welcoming. Do we want to allow that? Do we want to encourage that? Or do we want to say, look, let's make sure that we have a really hospitable soil for growth here in this country? And so I think when you take away the incentives, going back to kind of where we started, which is our tax code is built on trying to control behavior. What are the incentives? And we want to make it so that you are incentivized to build your business here, to grow the American economy and create great American jobs.
So I would just add quickly is, whether we like it or not, the world is also moving on tax policy, particularly on the international business side, where our friends in Europe are actively trying to steal our tax base, and in some cases already have. And that is a challenge that exists, and we simply have to confront it. It will require policy changes. It will require Congress's attention. And so the idea that Congress can just, you know, fall asleep at the wheel on tax policy just is not sustainable. And so addressing the TCJA, the international tax landscape is a challenge that any Congress is going to have to confront.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gordon, I had a feeling you were going to bring up the international tax code at some point. I saw an article, I think last week in the Wall Street Journal, basically saying as much that, you know, it's everyone's adopting this, but guess the U.S. Treasury is not seeing any of the benefits of it because all that money is going elsewhere. Is this the last?
They got rolled.
Yeah. So is this the final, is the TCJA the last word on tax reform, or does more need to be done on this?
I think we're going to need to constantly evolve. I think, you know, we have right now a global economy. We have businesses creating jobs that we didn't conceptualize 7 years ago, right? That we didn't, and that's a good thing. That is a good thing, especially with the continued rise of AI, the continued rise of technological advancements, we're going to see more of that. There will be new industries that you and I aren't thinking about right now that in 10 years might be multi-billion dollar companies. And I think that we need to make sure that our tax code, that our incentive is to make sure that those new endeavors are happening here in America. We want to make sure that we have a really hospitable place for companies to grow, for innovation to continue. And so I think the TCJA was a really great start. I was really, really enthusiastic to be a very, very small part of that. But I don't think there will ever be kind of the last word, because we're going to continue to grow and evolve, and as will the international companies that are trying to steal our international countries that are trying to steal our tax base. I totally agree with Gordon on that. And so we're going to need to stay in the game, not just pass a bill, wipe our hands and be like, all right, we're done here, because it's continuing evolving.
I would just add one little thing, and, you know, Michaela already touched on this, which was that the TCJA was the most substantial rewrite of the U.S. tax code since 1986, which should also tell us that Congress failed to evolve for decades. And the result was tremendously costly to the United States. U.S. firms were leaving our shores to go overseas because of how lousy our tax code was. The TCJA, I mean, just put that to an end. And but nevertheless, the world evolves. And so tax policy must continue to evolve with it.
Yes. Well, thank you both for joining us and bearing with us through those wonderful tech issues that we were having. You know, episode 141, we think we have it down pat. And of course, technology throws a wrench in the middle of that. But thank you both for joining us for this episode and breaking down the TCJA, the child tax credit, and what the future of tax policy might look like.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kyle. Thanks, Gordon.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Tune back in for our next episode, where our experts will provide clear, data-driven insights into today's economic and domestic issues. I'd also encourage you to check out any of the links in our show notes, and also follow us on social media to learn more about AAF. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play.